to have true success is to be free, you know, in your creativity, to be able to work with the people that you really love, and to be respected by your peers. And it doesn't mean that you have to sell millions of records, because I haven't. It just means that you get to make a living and do music and work on exciting projects. And, you know, that's basically it. I mean, it's just life.
This episode is brought to you by DistroKid. DistroKid is a distribution service that can get your music into all the DSPs like Spotify, Apple Music, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram. Over a million artists have used DistroKid. I'm one of those artists. I've used DistroKid to get my music out, distribute some of my songs. As you know, as I look into all of these distribution services, I test them out. And DistroKid is great. They offer a ton of features, annual fee, unlimited uploads, and you keep 100% of your royalties. Check out DistroKid.com. What's going on? Welcome to the New Music Business. I'm your host, Ari Herstand, author of How to Make It in the New Music Business, the book. Today, my guest needs no introduction, except I'm going to give her one. It is Imogen Heap. She is, of course, the artist behind the breakout song Hide and Seek, which has been used so many times in dances and shows and movies and trailers and remixed by Jason Derulo for his song. And I've been a fan of hers since even before that time period, from the Frou Frou days. And famously from the Garden State soundtrack, that Frou Frou song, you know, Let Go. That's her. I'm a huge fan. And this was just an absolute honor to have her on to discuss. Actually, oddly enough, we didn't really talk about her music very much or really at all, but more about what she has been doing over the last 10, 15 years to make the music industry more equitable and transparent, and working out metadata systems through blockchain, and her company that she started, the Creative Passport, which in the future, I'll let her explain it later on, but will hopefully remove all the confusion when it comes to data and credits and payment and all of that. Imogen Heap, of course, she is the Grammy winner. She has collaborated with countless artists like Taylor Swift and deadmau5 and Eric Whitaker and Jeff Beck, just to name a few. She's a Grammy winner. She has created these incredible gloves called the Mimu gloves. You should go watch her Tiny Desk performance, and she explains what these are and how they work. But Ariana Grande has used her gloves on stage, and other artists have used them. It is it's kind of like the new version of the theremin, except you have these gloves and they're hooked up to a computer, and you have tremendous flexibility when creating with these gloves on. Anyway, you're going to love this episode. I really encourage you to listen all the way through, especially to the very end when I ask her what it means to make it in the new music business. I loved her answer on this. And she is just such a brilliant mind and a wonderful person, and is doing so much good in the music industry, especially the independent music community. As always, you can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Ari Herstand. You can find Imogen Heap everywhere as well on Twitter, Instagram. But she talks about how she's kind of not doing social media anymore, and she just has her app, which we discuss and get into all about that. You can find all of us that make the show at Ari's Take on TikTok, Instagram, Twitter. And of course, visit aristake.com, get on that email list. That is where you're going to get the most relevant, up-to-date information about the new music business. Get on that email list, subscribe. It is at aristake.com. And like and subscribe to this show. Follow the show however you're listening to this right now. Just hit that subscribe button. Hit that up thumb if you're on YouTube. Leave a comment on YouTube. Leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Please pause. Just go leave a review. It really helps. All right, let's kick into the show. Imogen Heap, what's going on? Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Very happy to be here. Good to be here. Good to meet you.
Where are you right now? Where are you coming to me from?
I'm coming live and direct from Hackney in London.
Okay. Yeah. Very cool. Is this where you spent the last year and a half or so in quarantine? And
mostly,
plus,
yeah.
Plus, yeah.
But between here and my studio house. But during lockdown, I couldn't really go there. So, yeah, I kind of created a little mini studio here in Hackney, which
right.
is good because it turns out I don't really need anything else other than what I've got. So now we're renting out the house with the studio.
Oh, nice. Oh, that's great. Yeah. So what are you working on these days? What are you up to? Every time I check in over the last 15 years with Imogen Heap, it seems like you have your hands in something technologically fantastical that is happening. And I'm very curious where you're at right now on this whole journey to make the music industry a bit more streamlined and fair for artists.
Yeah. So, yeah, I guess the thing which is worth talking about here right now, not the other thing that I'm doing personally, is around this digital identity for music makers, kind of preparing us for Web3, preparing us for all the possibilities of the new services of the new era,
yes.
where we have multiple services looking out for artists with all the correct data intact, enabling to pay the right people 100% rather than 50%, because apparently 50% of royalties reach us right now. And it's a very slow process, and it's very hard to untangle. But the future is bright. We believe that for music and creativity. And we just want to empower and enable music makers right now to just start thinking about data, their own data, information about themselves, and taking responsibility for that so that in the future they can go in and author, change, verify information about themselves to help other people do business with them.
Is this through the Creative Passport program
right.
that you founded?
Yeah, it's called the Creative Passport. It's very much beta mode. It does actually not very much on the tin right now,
okay.
Other than just you're able to put some information about yourself and your skill sets and your projects and your inspirations and your anything that you might type anywhere about you, your biography or press image. In one place to kind of mm-hmm. share with people. In fact, I should have done that with you. I should have shared my Creative Passport profile and you would have seen all this stuff about me, like all the gear that I use, all of the plugins that I like, all the services that I appreciate, all that kind of stuff.
Is that all baked into a track, I guess? So break it down a little bit, just what you mean by kind of keeping all the data streamlined and all intact.
Okay.
What does that mean?
So essentially, we're trying to create a space, like home, for music makers' information that they control.
Mm-hmm.
So that, say, you pop up as an artist on Spotify or on Apple Music, or you've just you're going on a new tour, or you're about to be interviewed. Where does the information come from about you? And some of it's sourced from like Wikipedia, if you're lucky, you've got a page. Of which you can't write your own material there. It might be an old press image that maybe has or hasn't got permission.
Mm-hmm.
It's often that it doesn't represent who you are right now, and there's a lot of missing information. So this is about creating a platform, a nonprofit platform, for musicians to be able to host that information that could be useful to anyone, so that when we are on Spotify, it might have our updated profile information, or it might have, say, it might channel into our Creative Passport and have you could, so that a user journey on Spotify, for example, could go around and find out who's inspired by who. So they'd be scraping that data from the Creative Passport and potentially paying the Creative Passport for the holders themselves directly for that information that's useful to them as a product. So that's just one example. Another example could be somebody wants to see what songs have used the Neumann TLM-103 that I'm using.
Mm-hmm.
Or somebody might want to know what kind of services they trust, musicians. So this is basically a home of all kinds of information, like good knowledge that I have as a musician that other musicians might be interested in, or services might be interested in, they might be willing to pay for that. But the big goal is to essentially help the music industry not be fragmented with its information and have good data and not be having multiple different data sets around works that are all incomplete. So say like one company like the PRS, who distribute royalties for writers in the UK, they might have some information about a song, but they might be missing some information. So they've spent maybe a couple of £100 trying to like figure out who that other writer was when they talking to some other people. And then they found that writer. But then that is correct now in their data set, but it's not correct in ASCAP or in BMI or whatever,
right.
Some other. There's hundreds of them all over the planet, all these collection services, and they all basically every time they do that, every time they search for some information that they don't know, they that comes off the top of our royalties. Mm-hmm. So how can we stop that happening over and over again and help something like a data set arise?
Yes. So there's a lot there. And I'm it's great. And I want to actually dig deeper and get more nuance because people who are listening to this right now understood everything you just said. But I want to actually unpack that more. And because so there's a few issues with this. This has been a pet peeve of mine forever that Spotify never showed who the songwriters were, or now they're starting to, now they kind of do that, but they also don't show who the session musicians are, who played on the record, what mic, what gear did you use? I love all of that. I mean, that should all be there, the full credits list. You know, they're slowly rolling it out. The reason that it is so fragmented and it is so broken, and the reason that Spotify and Apple and everyone else were getting sued years ago, at least in the States, was because Spotify and all the DSPs never actually required any of this information of who the publishers were, the songwriters were, from the distributors, which would have solved it from the beginning. Had they just said, we're not going to put your song on our platform, you know, dear distributor XYZ, thank you for giving us your record. We want to put it up, but we can't until you tell us who's the publisher and who wrote these songs. And you need to give us that information because they have to clear that information if they're going to release it and they have to get the licenses. It was a huge misstep by all the DSPs that they didn't require that information from the get-go. So it's because the Spotify and all the others, these DSPs, these are the platforms that are hosting all the music, and that is they're getting all the music from distributors. Why not just go to distributors and say, and Spotify, and say, hey, why not, Spotify, make your distributors require all this information, every session musician, every publisher, all the gear. And if Spotify requires it, every distributor will do it. And then every distributor will make sure that they have that information. I'm curious why you went to kind of a third party over here instead of going direct to the DSPs.
Yeah. So we have had chats, of course, with lots of people. And many people go, oh, that's not my problem. That's somebody else's problem. That bit's our problem, but that bit's not our problem. So, you know, so it kind of really has to be artist driven who wear all of these hats. They're a recording engineer, they're a producer, they're a writer, they're a singer, they're a session musician, they're all these things in order to care about the whole self of the music as a role and all the different pieces, the kind of the mother role. I think also it's just, once you've dealt with one distributor or tried to get all of the information, if that was a prerequisite, like you had to have this information, what about all those songs that didn't for some reason have that information? Right. Then they wouldn't be on the platform. Then they still have to go and deal with the problem somewhere. They have to go and find that information, and then maybe they can't be bothered. So those songwriters from maybe long ago don't get their work up on Spotify. So the reason for doing it this way is we're not creating the data set of works. We are preparing our other musicians to have their, basically to be verified as the person they say they are, so that when this data set does start to arrive, which it will, it is, different organizations and companies and you know are in it to win it, and there is money in it for the people that do it correctly and properly, but they can't create an entire fulfilled data set without the artists going in and going, actually, that's not the saxophonist because I was in the room. You know, they're not going to be calling us up. Where are they going to call us? They can't phone us on our mobiles. They maybe they tried a Twitter account. I don't know. How are they going to find us? So we need to in our community, you know, reach out and go, hey, you were in that session. You should, you know, go in and fill that data in. It might even be that, I mean, I would like to think that all of the information that was true and correct that was given by whoever was giving it and it was proven true should be paid for that information to, you know, for all the money that they've then saved everyone else for doing it. So there should be some kind of bounty, you know, for putting good data in, for taking the time to get it right. And that then you should receive income for that. So then that would be an incentive for, say, the PRS and the writers and the publishers and the recording companies to put in good data because they're going to get cash back. So you've got to create incentives and you've got to create something that's going to be easier for everyone in the long run to do the right thing. You've got to just do that. Because if you try and, like, say, come on, everyone, we need to do the right thing. Come on, let's do all this. Right, they're just going to be like, no. You've got to make it easier and cheaper than it is to do the wrong thing and just be like, oh, I'm quite happy receiving all these backhanded benefits from the fact no one's credited correctly.
I mean, totally. And that is the reason that, at least in the States, the Music Modernization Act passed and got both the DSPs on board and the publishers and the labels on board, and essentially is what the Mechanical Licensing Collective, which launched in the States at the top of this year, they are collecting 100% of all mechanical royalties from the DSPs, just the U.S. mechanicals. So like you were talking about before with PRS, those listening to PRS is the performing rights organization in the UK, in the States. Just on the performance side, we have ASCAP, BMI, CSAC, but we also, that's actually only, performance royalties are only 50% of all the publishing royalties that are generated from streaming revenue. The other 50% are mechanical royalties. And so previously, before the MLC existed in the States, that's where Spotify and everyone else had no idea who to pay, because they're like, well, these mechanicals, unless the publisher or the songwriter comes to us and waves their hand and said, hey, I wrote that song, please pay me. There was no way to do this. So fortunately, the MLC is this body that is looking to solve that. It is still insanely fragmented, and that's, you know, that's only in the States. But everywhere else, like you said, yes, there's, I mean, almost 100 organizations all over the world that kind of represent all these rights.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, Ari, that is good. Yes. And the MLC is good news that they've created that. Except there's still the problem remains that if the mechanical royalties come in to the MLC and all the people that benefit from the royalties that come in from the MLC receive theirs, then there's bound to be, again, 50% of those royalties, which they won't know where to send because somebody over there in Singapore didn't know that they needed to sign up and get to those. Right. Oh, actually, that's my song over there. So the, of course, the like American publishers, and they're all doing it because they're like, yeah, we're in it to win it. And it's easy for us. And any money that doesn't get scraped up by, you know, by the correct who they're meant to be paying will go back to them. So the incentive is still twisted. You know, it's not. I don't know. I think I have no idea, but maybe after 4 years, you know, that's what happens with the PRS and other companies. If you can't pay out the money, then you just keep it.
So what it, with the MLC, it's 3 years and they actually divvy it up amongst the people they know who to pay, which is totally fucked up.
So there's no incentive, and that's the same everywhere. So there's no reason, because then, you know, even the big artists who don't need the money. I've probably received money from people that I shouldn't have money, because I'll be one of those people they know who to pay. So at the end of the year, they go, okay, let's give an extra little bit to everyone else. And they divide it up proportionally. So, you know, the big shots get still loads of more extra money that they don't need. So that's what we're trying to solve. It's like, how can we help music makers be aware and make it easy for people to do the right thing? If we can have this kind of platform that's centralized to us, each one of us, so that we can go in and go, you know, into a data set at some point and just kind of latch in and go, okay, this is how you need to pay me, this is my organization. That's the point we need to get to, which we're not going to get to by November or whenever they're doing the payout. But that's, that was definitely one of the driving forces, was like, okay, this thing called the MLC is going to arrive, and it's another similar, it's just the same thing. You know, I mean, yes, it's one step, because it's like, okay, so now people are getting paid mechanicals, but it's still the same problem, that those people aren't going to get paid and there's no incentive.
So what are you hoping happens with your platform, or just in general with the music industry? What should we do? An artist who's listening to this right now, because it's mostly independent artists listening right now and songwriters, and you're like, all right, this sounds great. Yes, I want to make sure I get my money. I want to make sure the credits are accurate and that my drummer that played on track three is credited properly and gets paid. You know, what do we do?
Well, we're not there yet. You know, we're maybe a decade away from everything being like truly integrated and ready to roll. But there are, you know, movements now in technology where we have the NFTs, this kind of ability to be able to put a piece of music out that's independent of any platform and be able to pay directly, a kind of digital artifact that's shared and can be exchanged. So there are possibilities for the future. What I would imagine Why I would say people should sign up now is just be prepared, become part of the movement of educated music makers who understand the value of data and where we're trying to go. Help us by being part of the numbers to influence change in the industry by showing that by force of numbers, say, you know, at the moment we're like 3,000. Mm-hmm. We're a beta project and we're just doing it under my own steam with occasionally a bit of grant money. So it's slow going. Sure. But already lots of people in the industry see us and believe that it's going to be a thing. So they're developing with the Creative Passport in mind as a kind of know your customer. So there's lots of hundreds of microservices that have the same problem. How do I know that that is the Imogen Heap that she says she is? How do I know it's not another person saying she's Imogen Heap? How do I know that is the correct publisher? You know, how can we help them deal with those issues? So we want to get that right from us. So we've got our house in order. So when the time does come, that you can essentially, what we want to happen is like the flow of, we want to lessen all admin, we want to take away admin basically, because we want to get on with music. So we want to go into a studio or we go to a venue or we're busking on the street or whatever we're doing, and we have a Creative Passport. Maybe that's on your phone, maybe it's whatever it is, maybe it's in your wrist by then. You'll go into a space, it'll be like, here's Imogen Heap. I've noticed her Creative Passport is here. So then every single plugin that you use on your door, like in your workstation, or maybe you've done some singing, you would basically select, Imogen Heap's in the house, she's here as a vocalist or as a guitarist or as a writer or whatever. And then all this information, even the very earliest ideas of a song, so even if I had a demo of a song that I'd improvised one evening, you know, during a live stream, and I found like four bars, it was like, that's a brilliant thing, I that's definitely going to be a song. So I might want to just store that on in a file somewhere. But imagine if that file was not just like a file that was going to get lost on my computer somewhere, but it was it went to a place that I use my Creative Passport to go in and author and go, this is the beginning of my idea. And then maybe I don't touch it for 2 years, but then later I'm like, I'm going to call up that thing again because I've just met this writer who probably might want to finish that. So then you send it over to that guy or that girl or whoever, and then they maybe do a bit more writing, and then it stays on the blockchain as another little piece of information. So there's always a nice breadcrumb trail, and it keeps going until it gets produced, and it's session musicians, and then maybe even management and record label, and all of these things like start to like click onto the song, like extra metadata. And then, then I imagine the song, like at the moment we have services full of songs, but I imagine that the future is songs as services. So this song has all the information that you might want to know about it. Everything, like it has interactions, it has tweets about it, it has like remixes, it has inspired pieces of artwork. It's like this massive like ball of stuff that's been inspired and all the kind of glue about what's been used in that song. And then all the services around the world, they have access to that, and they pay for that. They pay for that information to better their service, to increase like engagement on the platform. And then anyone who's attributed information to that song that is valuable should be paid instantly. So that's what I'd like to see.
And so, I mean, that's brilliant. And I hope we get there soon. That sounds amazing. And so you mentioned the blockchain and that this is all hosted on the blockchain. Is this built on the blockchain just because of the way the technology exists? And like I like how you mentioned the breadcrumbs, and you can kind of see, you know, as we know, if you're tracking just like currency on the blockchain, you can see every a record, a ledger, I suppose, of every transaction. But is that similar how this works? Is that every time a remix is done or a new instrument gets added, that's kind of like what a transaction is on the blockchain? Yeah.
Who knows? I mean, that's what I think could happen. I mean, that's definitely for the last kind of 3 or 4 years, that's what people are kind of moving towards, this kind of distributed ledger of information that ideally people would pull into, like I kind of almost see it like a river of music, that you're just kind of plopping some stuff, and then it goes downstream, and then there's some things over here, but it still retains all of its integrity, integral parts. Something like blockchain. It might be blockchain. Hopefully we won't ever have to say the word again. It'll just be like the internet, you know. And it'll just be like a thing that sits underneath everything and allows payment to flow, verification, you know, all the things that that kind of a lot of stuff is done with kind of, you know, companies over here and taking a bit of that. And hopefully we could just like really simplify that and allow people to do the fun bits, you know, the curation of that data. There's going to be so much amazing data. It's like a kind of, at the moment, all of the innovation that's really happened is around the information that's organized. And so that's with the labels, that's with like mass writes, mass recordings, compositions with the publishers, like huge amounts of data. So companies like Spotify can deal with that, you know, because they've got, okay, well, I'll work with these three major labels and then I'll go and pick some independent stuff off and I'll work with some distributors. And it kind of, but there's no way for us. I mean, there is now Spotify for Artists, but it's just kind of, it's slow, you know, we're always the last one in the chain to play a part of the party. And we're like the first ones to put anything in. So the way that I imagine it would be, I kind of completely forgot what I was talking about now. Completely forgot. I had
Way that it would, the way that as you go through the process, the information gets added and just how that will eventually work out to be
what it is. Yeah. The point was that you have, all of this information with the big organizations. But imagine if you had like 100 million music makers. There's loads of us, by the way. There's like 300 million of us. I mean, only 100,000 of us actually make a full-time living out of it, and I'm gratefully one of those. But there's this huge curve of people who make music and DJ, and they're doing a bit of this, and they're working twice, you know, doing podcasts and all kinds of things. But then imagine if your data was also just as organized and as accessible, or more way more accessible than the record label data. Imagine what kind of services could like proliferate off of that. Because then they've got all this amazing data like inspiration, gear list, projects, I don't know, correct lyrics, reasons behind songs, where you wrote that song, in what cafe. You could add a whole new layer to like Google Maps or something else. You could design your holidays around where songs are written. You could even like decide, this is actually one of the main reasons I wanted to do it, was if you, I've done like stuff for charity. So Sendai Earthquake, I wrote a piece of music around the Sendai Earthquake. It's called Lifeline. And it was really hard for me to kind of triangulate how to get money to someone, how to get the fans to pay for the song, and then for the song to pay for the charity. And I just thought, wouldn't it be just be so nice if I could, like, you know, say another earthquake like happened somewhere, I would be like, okay, all songs, all royalties of Lifeline as of today will be going to this charity, so that you can immediately divert payments. Obviously, some people, if anyone else played on that, they'd have to agree to that, but they would be able to do that because you'd just be able to fire it out across the creative passport. And if they didn't, they'd receive their bit. But then you can imagine that radio stations around the world would choose to play songs that they knew were funding the relief of an earthquake. So it's that kind of like interoperability and like sharing of information, instantaneous kind of connection with the audience that could happen if we had this kind of home space.
I love that. And I mean, shout out to DistroKid, the largest distributor in the world, who actually has that built in. And during the BLM movement last June and the protest, and they actually teamed up with a few of the organizations and enabled every artist, if they wanted to divert a percentage of the royalties because they're a distributor, they could say, yes, 50% of all these royalties from this song is going to Color of Change or something like that, because that's have payment splitting built in. It's the platform, or I guess what they have built in is payment splitting, where right now I can distribute a song and I can designate who gets paid what percentage for anything. You know, splitting up the royalties. But that's great.
Super great.
That's just one component.
That's super, super good. So each one of those like brilliant ideas of one service.
Yes.
Multiplied by, you know, thousands of services,
right,
for the artist to decide, yes, I want all of my songs all around the world to do that thing, and have the ability to do it.
Real quick, I want to let you know about Too Lost. Too Lost is a new distribution company to the space, and let me tell you, I am very impressed with them. I got a full deep dive demo with the founder, and they're very innovative. And when you come into the distribution space at this stage with how crowded it is, you better be innovative, and they are. Yes, they will get your music out to Spotify, Apple Music, all the places, plus 450 other outlets around the world. They do not take a commission. This is why 300,000 artists and labels have already used them. They've already distributed 7 million songs. They offer payment splitting, and they don't charge your collaborators for this service for the payment splitting. They will just pay your collaborators directly for free. They have publishing administration with BMG, so you know it's legit. A lot of distributors have fallen into trouble with using some other less than legit pub admin services. Well, Tulos is partnered with BMG. You know it's legit. They offer instant royalty advances. This is something that's very cool. And if you have historical streaming data and you need just a bulk payment up front, they can see how much your music has earned in the past. I'm like, all right, we think we know what you're going to earn in the next 3 years. Here's a check for $100,000 or whatever it will be. And you can just click a button and get that distributed and into your account immediately. They do lyrics and credits distribution for free. They have a very innovative analytics platform where, yes, you will see real-time analytics for Spotify, Apple Music, but also Pandora, Deezer, SoundCloud, and Peloton. They're the only ones that do Peloton. They also have a service where you can search the internet wherever your music is being used, and it will just show you a chart of everywhere, every TikTok video, everywhere, every YouTube video, everywhere your music is possibly being used. I've never seen this before. That was very cool. They'll register you with SoundExchange, and they have a fraud prevention tool, and they're doing fraud prevention. So if you're worried about your music, you know, getting a bot attack or something like that and getting ripped down, which we've seen is a big issue, they have fraud prevention tools that are better than most other distributors that I have seen. Check out Tulost. You can just go to tulost.com, use the promo code Ari's Take for 3 months free and try them out. Let them know what you think. You mentioned NFTs earlier, and I know that you did an NFT drop and you did it, I believe it was April through Endless, and it was on the Ethereum blockchain. I know you've been working on Ethereum for years. I'm curious if you've been hearing, if you've been getting pushback on just the environmental issue. Now, I know that your NFT drops, the press release says, was carbon negative because you donated to, you know, carbon offset organizations, stuff like that. But I'm curious why you chose Ethereum versus the other proof of stake blockchains that don't use nearly as much, and so you wouldn't actually have to do all this carbon offsetting and all of that.
Sure, yeah. I mean, so yeah, I've been kind of, my first project was with Ethereum. We just did it like a month after they launched, so I do have a kind of, yeah, a friendly feeling towards Ethereum. Sure. The other reason was that we didn't think that we'd get the traction on the smaller kind of newer markets on the you know, on Hikecnook and things like that. We didn't think that we would capture the awareness of the whales, which we were hoping to get, which we didn't get in the end. So it's all completely rubbish anyway. So I suppose, yeah, I did get a lot of backlash for that. However, you know, the positive thing that came out of that was, I mean, it didn't feel good at the time. You know, I was like, come on, guys, you know that I'm not doing it to ruin the environment, and that I think a longer term, and I know, of course, the risks, but yeah, we did kind of massively, like, buy, I think I like cancelled out all of my environmental impact as a person for a whole year with one of them. And then the next one did the same and the same. So, and then other artists saw that and did the same. So it was just, it was an example of, you know, as you said, how it worked with DistroKid, that you could put a percentage of your NFT to an organization that you cared about. And that meant that the person buying it was also then invested and kind of understood the value of how important it was to retain that. And then the next time they sell it, that will also go to that, to that organization. So I think it's a way to, it was a mechanism to show how, I guess, in a, on a bigger space with a, yes, it did create kind of some negative buzz. But in the long run, every single blockchain has to be green. Otherwise they're going to fail.
Yes.
Nobody is going to, if you've got like Bitcoin blockchain over here who's like, you know, pumping out the stuff. And then you've got this really cool one over here, which is like green and totally not pushing out anything bad into the environment. Then who are you going to go with? And they both do the same thing. They're going to go over there. So everybody, ultimately, the pressure, whether it's me or a company, is feeling that. And it is going to go that way. It's just, and it's always been going that way. It's just time, you know, it's time and money and they're very close, Ethereum.
Are you talking to the Ethereum people? Because I know they've been saying they're going to move from proof of work to proof of stake for years. And I think we're all just waiting with bated breath every year when that's going to happen.
I feel like they just, I mean, I've been a little bit out of it for the last couple of months, but I maybe I'm wrong, but I feel like they have done something kind of note in that direction in the last month or so. I don't know exactly. Sorry, because I've just been busy doing other stuff.
No worries. I was curious if you had an in.
It's their life. It's their lifeblood. You know, they've got to get it right. And there's no point. If you look at the opposite, which is like the oil dollar, how much worse is that? You know, so nobody talks about that. It's like, oh, it's really bad. It did an NFT. I'm like, okay, but what happened about your credit card and this and that and all the things that had to make plastic and whatever, you know, and the other organizations and what do they do? And, you know, it's just not
the plane tickets you buy and the vehicles that you purchase and on and on and on. Right. I think that was just because NFTs exploded in the artist community earlier this year, and artists tend to be a bit more environmentally conscious than finance people when it was mostly just dealing with the commerce community previously. That wasn't really discussed as actively as it was when it became the artist community. So that's kind of where it went that way. But yes, I'm curious, do you think NFTs are here to stay? Do you think there will always be some kind of an NFT in the future?
Definitely. I hope there will. I mean, at the moment, it's like, it's not a very sexy name, is it? Non-fungible token.
Right.
but essentially, it's like a piece of art that's exchanged between two people. And you can define the parameters of what that art is and what it does. So whether it's a film or whether it's something you're trying to raise, or, I mean, it's anything really. It's just at the moment, like, people are doing like little videos and little GIFs, and there's some lovely things on there. Like Holly Herndon and Matt Dryhurst did a really beautiful set. And there's some really beautiful, it's amazing. But for me as an artist, I'm like, I feel so excited about finally having an opportunity to not think in terms of 3 to 5 minutes long songs, and that I could release something that's like a 20 long minute piece of music that maybe only one person really loves, you know, but it's out there and they've got it and they've supported me. Or maybe it's that, you know, I find it hard to go in to the studio and just finish a damn song because I've got like a million things going on and my daughter's around and, you know, I just can't get into the flow for long enough. But I can, you know, make a quick thing on Endless and kind of express my creativity in a smaller time nugget that is still interesting and fans like it. So I think it's nice to have that flexibility, nice to have that box kind of broken open, that you can fill that release however you like. And that's what's exciting. But I think it's kind of breaking us out of the mold and allowing musicians and artists to be freer in their concepts and in their formats, and also being able to work, you know, cross multidisciplinary media, all kinds of different things, and being able to pay everyone. You know, that's the problem with, you might release a video on YouTube and, you know, you might receive a ton of money. No, you won't receive a ton of money unless you're like massive, but you'll get some money. But then what will the videographer get? You know, how will they be recognized? Or what about your artwork that went up on, you know, you got this really nice cover art that actually everyone really loves and it helps sell the music, but they don't get anything for that every time it's sold. So I think it's a really great kind of fun explore space. And it feels like a playground.
Yeah.
And I don't know what it's going to manifest as, but I think it's going to be very positive. The thing which we need to do already is to, again, find a way. I mean, it's moving very quickly. Like how to kind of get, again, kind of cookie cum trail back to the writer, the photographer, the whoever it was, like, so that you can go see more of their work and that they're all connected. And then there's going to be VR galleries of NFTs and the flow of kind of movement between and being able to follow artists and see their work projected in different VR spaces or, you know, augment or kind of like put it onto a wall that you're talking to somebody about and do a conference with it. And then that pays the people. You know, it's just once it's all kind of interlaced and connected and all the right information is there feeding back to the right people, then we can, the payment happens because now we have this technology. So
you have developed your own app, your own platform with the Heapster community that you call it. And it's, I think you reference, it's kind of like your own version of Patreon. It's just a patronage where the baseline model is like £2 a month or £20 a year, or there's a sliding scale up to people can do £250 a year if they'd like. And it's really cool. I mean, I became a member of the community and I was going through the app and looking at the videos and you're doing all these live streams and I guess lifting the veil a bit for this community on your process. What inspired this version and what inspired you to do an app like this?
Well, the company originally that we did it with is a company called Superpass. It's Juliana Meyer, she's the CEO. And she came to one of our early, it was called Mycelium at the time, these workshops that we were hosting all around London. And I really liked the idea of her platform. So her platform idea was to allow musicians to host all of their music in one place and for them directly to receive music on their own app that would also pay rights holders. And you could put demos up there, you could chat to your fans, you know, and that seemed like a fantastic idea. The problem was that then when she tried to get the licenses off, you know, Sony, they were like, sure, you can have them for 10 grand a year. And she's like, what? You know, I was like, excuse me, they're my song. Can you just give them to her, please? And then you'll receive money on the payment of the plays. And I realized that that's what's happening in every single music service. They ask this upfront money. It makes it impossible to create these new business models. And then we're stuck with these big companies with the tiny, you know, royalties that we have. Because major music companies like to receive money upfront that they don't have to give to the artist because it's not under the same remit. It's not in the contract. So that's what happened with Spotify and everyone. They had a piece of that, of the pie.
And it happened with YouTube. It happened with Facebook. It's essentially bribes for them to go away, which is infuriating, especially when, like, you know, they sue Facebook because a lot of these songs are on their platform. And then Facebook's like, here's $100 million. Can you just go away and we'll figure it out? We promise. And they're like, all right, this works for us. And of course, the labels and the publishers keep that money. They don't pass it along to their artists. Yeah. And but now they have the rights to use it, which is kind of crazy.
I think there have been people like you know, Taylor Swift, who'd kind of pressured labels like Universal to divvy up some of those payments and have been effective. And so, you know, artists can sometimes move the needle in the right direction. But yeah, it just really upset me, the whole thing. So we basically did pay, I think, the 10 grand in the beginning. And then, well, I probably shouldn't say this in public, but now we just basically put it up there and I don't care. So there's like, because there's only like, there's like 300 fans or whatever. And it's like, what are you going to do? So we put all of my entire catalogue up there, all the demos. And really the idea was, there was no place to do that online anymore. I used to have a website back in the day, like 25 years ago, or 20 years ago, where fans would go and it was very like a kind of community vibe. There was no like speak to the masses and everybody can chip in. It was just very close, nice, you know, real fans chatting. And I would talk about my process and that's how I made my records. But then, you know, the Twitter came along and I was excited about it. I was like, oh, this is cool. I can like give more, you know, about my creative process. And they featured me on Twitter, which is why I've got a lot of followers that I probably shouldn't have because they were just like, oh, okay, who's that person? I'll follow that when it started.
Sure.
But then it got too big and then I couldn't reach people. And the same with Instagram and everywhere. It's just like too many people. I can't really talk to anyone meaningfully. So then I went back to the app during lockdown because all my team were on furlough, you know, supported to some degree by the government. And I was kind of like on my own, just going, shit, you know, how am I going to pay for stuff? How am I going to keep the creative passport going? How am I going to, I had all these things and I had so much work to do without my team. And I just thought, I need to get back in touch with those guys, like the fans. I need to be there. I need to talk about my process. I need to talk this through with somebody. I just reached out to them. We basically already had the app, but I started to talk more, and I did these blogs, and then just through chatting with them on Discord, they kind of encouraged me to just put everything up. You're like, oh, I've found a little version of this song. You don't know I've got it, but I have got it. Can I put it up on the app? So actually my fans are putting all this stuff up that I didn't know was out there, but it is there. And they're just putting it up. I'm like, fine, just do it. I don't care. I'm fine now. We're all in bed. And it's really freeing. It's like, it's really just so nice to just be like, warts and all, that's who I am. That's who I was when I was 14. That's who I was when I was drunk doing that thing. That's who I was, you know. And they just don't care. They're happy just to know you and to be on a level with you. And it's really freeing for me to just let it all hang out, basically. We have these amazing sessions. Sorry, I'll just tell you because it's really lovely.
Keep coming.
Every Thursday. Actually, it's not every Thursday now because I've changed dates with Scout. Anyway, every Wednesday or Saturday, I chat in this chair, which is like an egg chair. And it's got like a tablet in it and a little camera, microphone, speakers, and a little band for my heart rate. And basically, my fans have a way to kind of go, there's this bot. Okay, it doesn't sound very sexy right now. It's a chat bot, and it's called Imogen, augmented Imogen. And the idea was, how can I basically come off social media, which I have pretty much, and I just went into my app, and it's been so lovely. Every now and then I tweet something, but very rarely. And so I was like, but how can I still like be in touch with that world? Because I don't want to be answering the same questions again, like, Imogen, when are you going to come on tour? Or Imogen, what's this song about? Or Imogen, whatever it is. And I was just like, so I just basically had to stop the noise and go small, go back with the ones who really wanted to talk about stuff with me. And who really, the diehard, you know, the core fan base. But it is a 24/7 world, and you still might discover something, you know, on Twitter or wherever that you actually do want to follow up with. So I was like, how can we build an AI that could in time field these incoming messages, and also for the creative passport? So it's like, Imogen, blah, 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 asking me a question. And because I sometimes do feel like a bot, I'm like, I don't know, or I wrote this song about, or I'll just copy and paste that, you know. Right. So why not just be like truthful about it, and they can have the answer from a Imogen. But if they do ask me something that's not been asked before, then they get to talk to me in the chair. And then we have these discussions like you and I are, and we talk about everything. We talk about my sex life or my lack of it. Well, actually my just recently revived sex life, which is wonderful. so good. Or it could be about, you know, my sister's death, or it could be about whatever it is, or it could just be something funny. Oh, actually, one of my fans, this is amazing, diagnosed me with, I've got this thing called Hashimoto's, which I didn't know I had, but I was basically talking in the chair. It's like an underactive thyroid, but it basically shows up as a bit of a goiter, so you can't see it really, but there's like a little growth there on my neck. And this fan called Di noticed that I had a slightly enlarged thyroid, and she was like, you need to go to the doctor because I think you've got a goiter. And I was like, where?
Oh my God.
So I went to the doctor. I had a goiter and I got it diagnosed, and I have Hashimoto's, which is the same as my mum, which explains my lack of sex drive, my depression, my anxiety, my overweightness over the last 6 years since childbirth. So this chair is like this incredible, like, it feels like a massive hug, you know, that people are looking out for, my fans are looking out for me. We're having these discussions. It's like therapy. So actually the app started out by just kind of, okay, let's put lots of stuff on there. And it's worked out as literally this kind of pulled me through the lockdown, pulled me through horrible, like everyone had. And also like helps me with my health and my sex life, because they just recommended a dating app. And I've now met this great guy. I shouldn't talk about it. Don't want to jinx it. So it's like really random. But the listening chair is called the listening chair. And it's the acronym TLC is also tender loving care. So I feel like that's what I want my AI to be, you know, to kind of help me navigate my life, help me know and kind of discover things that are really going to excite me as a person, as an artist, and to have my tools to hand. So as an accomplice, really. And in time, maybe we'll make music together. And in time, maybe my AI will go off and like sit on other AIs of people that I really respect, that they're learning and how they've trained their AIs. So we're slowly together doing these workshops, doing these sessions in the chair. We create these Q&As, and then the fans go in and edit them to bite-sized chunks that Augmented Imogen can then have in her knowledge store. And then somebody else asks me the same question, it'll be there. So it's like this really lovely cycle. And in fact, in the future, I'm going to start taking all of my interviews in the chair. So then you would also be contributing to AI Imogen.
Ooh, nice. So are you training your AI in a musical realm as well? Or in the future, is the Augmented Imogen going to write and compose and create your music and while you're playing with your kid?
With me.
Yeah. Oh, okay, with you.
Definitely. Yeah, without a shadow of a doubt. Yeah.
So your co-writing partner will be your AI.
One of them, yeah. I mean, if I'm extremely busy and I need to get a song to a certain point and I can like type in a few parameters, it's trained off entirely off my music. And, you know, I have my go-to chords. I have my go-to inversions. I have my go-to structures. But equally, you know, once it gets to that point, it could equally help me get out of my patterns. So I could be like, hey, AI Imogen, could you like just throw me a complete curveball? Like, what's the least type of music that I've ever written? Could you just throw me up some chords? And I'd be like, and that would then help me rediscover an entirely new way to write that I would then adopt into myself. Mm. So it's like, it's not about kind of carbon copying what I do. I think it's about like upping the game of creativity by highlighting your patterns and helping you get out of them. That's what I'd love to happen. And that maybe, you know, we're on stage together and AI Imogen, I don't feel like I want to anthropomorphize her. Like I want her to, or they, I don't know what this person, this thing will choose in the future. But you know, it might be that instead, so say my emotional contextual information that comes in from the camera, maybe that might end up becoming different colors. So maybe there's like a kind of color language that emerges. So when you see you hear the voice replying to you as you've just spoken to it with your camera and you're exchanging discussions with AI Imogen, AI Imogen might like go from different colors and you're like, oh, that's when she's slightly nervous. Or, oh, okay, I can tell she fancies me or whatever it might be. You kind of visualize that.
And you want this?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, absolutely. And then, so people kind of, I imagine that, I don't know, but what I think right now is that AI Imogen will take on a persona, like an aesthetic persona, which could be, I don't think it's going to be a person that won't look like me, but maybe she'll be there'll be a cityscape, you know. So maybe if I'm in the city, if I'm in London, AI Imogen might take on the character of a city, and the lights that come on might be how excited I am by the conversation, or they might just all go out when I'm like bored, or AI Imogen's bored, and then someone's like, delete AI Imogen. I don't know. But it's very exciting. And then you know, take it into the VR world you know, how you can exist as a human and the AI visually in that space and kind of create together, and how other people can then go in and like touch AI Imogen, you know, and kind of pull bits out and with the music and, you know, I have no idea. but it's very exciting. And it's early days. It's basically a chatbot right now.
Right. But crazy. That's cool. I mean, I think in the songwriter community, we're like, the AIs are coming for our compositions. They're going to eventually write all the songs in the future. But I like how you look at this as more of a collaboration and an augmentation of you and your artistry. And I like that it you can only... she or they will challenge you in the future to actually become more creative. That's cool. I haven't seen it displayed or illustrated like you just did in such a positive light before.
And everything that we use, that like, say if we go and use a drum machine, it's kind of like we've just used a drum machine. It's made us do a cool beat that we would never normally do because we just don't know how to play the drums. So that's already like, it's an early version. It is that. It's like an extension of that. And we're quite happy to do that. And we know that it ups our game. Like, oh, yeah, that fat beat. So we're going to go off and do this thing that we wouldn't normally do because we're just not quite that cool yet. But it's helped us be cool. So we've got this cool beat to do. Yeah.
I love it.
So, and the other thing I think is that just like, this is maybe a bad example, but GM food. So like in England, you have to have like a message on your packaging that says whether it's GM modified or not. So you could have a similar thing, like a kind of code that, like in France, you have to put, if a photo or an image has been photoshopped, you have to say this image has been photoshopped. So it could be the same with music or art or generative art. You could have a kind of percentage or some kind of like, you know, you don't even really look at it, but you just go, okay, you glance it and you understand, okay, this is 90% AI generated, or it's like 90% human generated, or 100%. And then people could like search music depending on the variance of like how much percentage of what and what. People might only choose AI generated music for maybe because it deals with fast paced 3D virtual animatic stuff better than a human would, which I'm sure it would. But then the human in the loop, which that's the term I learned the other day, would then go in and tweak that and make it, you know, kind of put it into the environment of the human, and the human's going to be watching it, not an AI. Well, maybe also an AI, who knows? AI signals in the cinema.
It's like you look at the nutritional information on the back of a face, you're going to similarly, what's the breakdown? What's the makeup of this thing?
And then I think there's no threat, because as long as you're, you know, transparent with what you're selling and what you're receiving, I think it's important. And I think that then, I think if we had that, people maybe be less threatened.
Amazing. Amazing. Imogen, I have so many other questions, but I don't have time to get to them today. This has been mind-blowing, illuminating, and really incredible. And we didn't even get a chance to talk about your Mimu gloves, but I encourage everybody. I was watching the Tiny Desk performance where you explained it, and I thought that was brilliant. And it's so cool to see that those are taken off and used by Ariana Grande and other artists experiment with them. And so congratulations on everything that you've done. I love I just love where you have taken your career, and it's as an artist in the industry, I think all of us are very appreciative of what you've done to give back to the artist community and how you are working and using your platform and your resources and your know-how and your brilliance to help push us in this direction that we need to be going in terms of equity and fairness and getting everybody the credit and the payment they deserve. So thank you for all of that from all of us.
Thanks. It's very kind, Ari. I feel very nice now.
Of course.
Very, very kind. Thanks so much.
Good. I have one final question that I ask everybody who comes on the show, and that is, what does it mean to you to make it in the new music business?
In the new music business, I would say to have the freedom to do exactly as you please. Like, not to feel restricted, not to feel like, oh, I have to go that route because that's the way that other people make success, have to do that. To have true success is to be free, you know, in your creativity, to be able to work with the people that you really love, and to be respected by your peers. And it doesn't mean that you have to sell millions of records, because I haven't. It just means that you get to make a living and do music and work on exciting projects. And, you know, that's basically it. I mean, it's just life. It doesn't have to be, you know, you make a number one. That's for a certain type of like character that I could never do. I could never do that thing of like keeping that up. Never been interested in it either. Just very much want to be true to my creativity and feel free as an artist to explore and grow and experiment and be supported by my friends and family and fans, which I am. And it's great.
I love it. I love it. Imogen Heap, thank you so much. This is great.
Cheers. Thank you.
Cheers. Take care. This episode is brought to you by DistroKid. DistroKid is a distribution service that can get your music into all the DSPs like Spotify, Apple Music, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram. Over a million artists have used DistroKid. I'm one of those artists. I've used DistroKid to get my music out, distribute some of my songs. As you know, as I look into all of these distribution services, I test them out, and DistroKid is great. They offer a ton of features, annual fee, unlimited uploads, and you keep 100% of your royalties. Check out DistroKid.com.